beginning is a very delicate time.
The sleeper must awaken.
It is by will alone I set my mind in motion.
I must cleanse the way between us.
Try looking into that place where you dare not look. You'll find me there staring back at you.
I must conquer the worm. Conquer Shai-Halud.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
For he is the Kwisatz Haderach.
Hey, John.
I want to talk about Dune.
Yeah, I know. You want to talk about Dune.
I had this thought because I know that you're a Star Trek fan.
Oh, I love Star Trek.
You've hosted podcasts before, and I just want to say this real quickly. You had me on a podcast once, the election night 2016.
Yeah, that's true.
Right, and it was a Star Trek themed podcast, and we talked a lot about Star Trek and politics. And it was during that podcast that I began to, for the first time, express misgivings, a lack of confidence in the Democratic candidate's strategy. And in that podcast, I probably said something along the lines of, I don't know, this could go either way.
Is that true? I'd have to go back. I mean, I believe you, but I do remember where we were. We were in Rockefeller Center in New York City in a professional suite. And it was the day of the election. Like I was planning, when we were done, I was going to get on the subway and go vote. And I think I said, you know, there's no chance that Trump could ever win, right? And you disagreed? You thought he could?
Yes, there's something about that.
Wow.
We were trying not to talk politics so much. But it was inescapable, right? It was 2016. It was the day it happened. So I just bring this up, this memory up, because, you know, I've started watching Star Trek Discovery, second season.
Yeah.
I didn't really love the first season. I do like Trek. I do like Star Trek. It's no Dune, but we'll get to that in a second. And so I'm watching it, and I'm liking it a little bit more than the first season. I do like Star Trek, and I had this thought, and I wanted to throw it at you, right?
Yeah.
Are you right? Star Trek, you ready for this?
I'm ready. I don't know. You said it's no Dune, and I'm just thinking like dilithium crystals is a much better way to travel than spice, but sure. Okay, go right ahead.
I'm sorry. Dilithium crystals is, you know, basically, first of all, let's call them what they are, plot crystals, right? Right?
As opposed to plot powder, sure.
Well, no. Hold the fuck on, Jordan. a magic crystal you put in your boat to go fast. It's basic or whatever. Frank Herbert was saying, hey, here's how we're going to travel the stars. And that's by getting really fucked up on the best, on this orange cocaine that, and some people, when they take it, they get so fucked up, they're able to literally rip open the cosmos. And like, come on, dude, that's the best.
Oh, yeah. I'm not saying it's not cool to watch. I'm saying it's not very, it's not very an effective method of travel.
Why? Okay, right. So anyway.
All right. So yeah, Star Trek, you love it.
No. I'm still wrapped up about as a plot device.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say
that. As a plot device, spice is cooler than dilithium crystals.
I guess it's cooler. I'm just saying, like, you know, it's not how I'm getting a Risa. But anyway, go on.
Because I hate to break this to you, but the whole concept of Star Trek Discovery,
is the
improbable secret discovery in the 23rd century of a spice-like way to navigate the cosmos.
That is true. I was talking. Discovery is but Discovery is.
I'm sorry. Did
thing.
I just hear you roll your eyes? Did I just did I hear the sound of marbles turning inside ocular cavities?
You know, it's true. The Black Alert. The what do they call them? How do they move around in Discovery?
Spores.
They're friggin'. Yeah, their spores is pretty Dune-like. I actually never thought of that.
So here's the thought that I had.
Yeah.
And that is Star Trek is part of the Dune cinematic universe.
Whoa. Say it again, because it's such a heavy sentence. I need to hear it a second time.
Dune, or Star Trek is part of the Dune cinematic universe.
How do you feel? How have you come up to this conclusion?
So what year... What year, approximately, what's the most, where are we in terms of the current Star Trek? Picard, which is happening in the most current version of Star Trek.
That's the year 23-something-something.
All right. So when does Dune take place?
10,006 or something ridiculous.
The year 10,191. Pretty good year.
Well, I mean, they could be using the Jewish calendar.
That would be, what year is it in Judaism? 5-7?
We're like 5790 or something hot like that. You know, we're doing good.
That'd be really funny if like, if Dune was like,
I mean, it's a desert. It's a desert. You know, it's a desert that's hotly contested by multiple factions. There is a lot of religious nonsense going on there.
As somebody who is half Mexican, I see Dune and I see it as an allegory for my people who are proud desert people.
Wow.
So Dune is about colonization and people putting up borders and walls.
Sure.
And I don't know what the worms are. I never know what the worms are. Don't say it.
I didn't say anything.
Okay. One reason I don't talk about the worms with you.
Yeah.
Because I just think it's an invitation to gratuitous phallus jokes.
Well, I mean, if you're doing from a Mexican thing, the worms kind of look like giant burritos.
That is the worst thing. That's not wrong.
They look like burritos, sure, especially in this movie. They're not filled, though, with beans. They're filled with spiky vagina dentata.
Right. See, this is why I don't talk about the worms with you, because we eventually get somewhere. The worms should be respected.
Yeah.
The worms are a brilliant creation.
I love them.
They're not just an opportunity to make burrito dick jokes or to speak French.
How do you feel that this is Star Trek, though? Because that one's new.
I'm just saying that, you know, first of all, they're both a couple of utopian-esque visions of a future. They're both stories that these two dudes in mid-century America, they're both visions.
Talking about Herbert and Roddenberry.
Yes.
Frank Herbert and Gene Roddenberry, sure.
Of humanity's future. And I'm just saying that there's plenty of time in a 10,000-year structure for Star Trek to morph into Herbert's future of a drug-addicted, royal caste system where mutant acid heads drag starships across the universe filled with space witches.
Yeah, all right. No, I get that. So you're saying the Federation will dissolve and the Shaddai Empire will spring up in its... Rise from his ashes. So how do you feel that Dune is a utopia? Because, you know, it's a little sketchy to me, because we have a vision at the beginning of the film of, you know, Jose Ferrer as the emperor, and it certainly looks beautiful. I mean, it looks like the interior of the Oyster Bar. That's how nice it looks up there, with a lot of good green paneling and elegant gowns and a lot of dogs running around.
If I ever make it to the Oyster Bar again, I'm never going to see it the same.
But then, you know, the Harkonnens are gross. The planet of Arrakis, the Dune planet itself, has got tremendous internal strife, and its natural resources are being exploited. And even Caladan, we don't see that much of Caladan other than a lot of water. And then, you know, it's vaguely Shakespearean kind of.
It seems nice. It rains. I imagine Caladan's a bit like, you know, like Portland.
Oh, it's, yeah.
There's a lot of dogs. There's a lot of pugs.
Totally like Portland. I mean, they would be drinking pour over coffee in Caladan for sure. But, you know, they're very serious there. and they don't crack a smile. The Harkonnens speak almost like in a totally different way, but their planet is gross. And then the Dune planet is messed up. So again, how do you feel that it's utopian?
I'm sorry. Now I just went emotionally to a place where I'm like, I'm going to write fanfic about, you know, Giedi Prime. That's where the Harkonnens are from. I want to write fanfic about, you know, maybe a nice neighborhood. Maybe there's a part of Giedi Prime where, you know, people are like, it's not that bad. It's, you know, there's the heart plugs, you know, they're not great.
We mostly see belching steam. We see, like, you know, serfs being attacked by floating barons in vaguely sadomasochistic ways, but we don't. It's a PG film.
You know, so on one, you know, Giedi Prime, on one hand, strange black liquid falls from the sky.
Yeah.
And that's not great. On the other hand, flowers.
Yeah.
There's lots of flowers. Or at least in that one scene where the poor slave boy.
Yeah, and a lot of and they, you know, they don't cast aspersions.
If but look, I didn't say it was a vision. Like what Roddenberry's utopia is imperfect, right? I mean, you know, like I think Frank Herbert in a way was like, we have a trippy humanity will first of all succeed.
Well, survive.
Well, not just survive, it thrives. In Herbert's Dune, without computer, you know, in Herbert's Dune, there are all of these strange factions and tribes that run the universe, but certainly humanity is successful. It's not dystopian. Like, you know, like it would suck to live on Giedi Prime unless you are Raban the Beast. Then it's pretty good, right?
Yeah, sure.
You get to do whatever you want. You get to walk around eating roast meat off a bone.
Yeah, yeah, and if you're Fade Rutha, when you're not working out,
nice treated fits. Like,
yeah, yeah, very nice.
But I'm just saying that's why I call it utopian, because it's clear that, you know, and that humanity in Frank Herbert's vision, 10,000 years from now, we've also started to evolve into spacing guild, into people with blue and blue, you know, into these different sort of. You know, Muad'Dib is certainly a different life form from a human. He's not entirely human, is he? Like,
once you drink that water of life, you know, you're going to go to new places.
That's why I call it utopia. You know,
okay.
You know, I can joke about the timeline, but these are both visions from these two men of, you know, like, and this runs counter to all the dystopian stuff, you know, that was coming out in the 60s and 70s, the Omega Man and Soylent Green and,
sure,
you know,
sure.
Logan's Run, you know, like these are two stories that say that they don't say the future is without conflict, but they say that humanity thrives
and is going to achieve a level of certainly technical wonderment, you know, is going to be able to do some incredible things.
Yes. And I'm just saying,
all right, I'll buy that.
I'm just saying that Data leads a revolution, the Butlerian Jihad.
Right. Yeah. Which is that ever mentioned in the movie?
Or no, I, you know,
they mention no, or AI. AI does not exist in the Dune of the movie. And in the books, you know why. It's because of the Butlerian Jihad.
Humanity fights a war against artificial intelligence and computers and trains one of the most powerful sects. Ooh, wow. How did I mispronounce that word? Sects. Mm. I hope you heard the C in there, not the X.
Oh, no, we got it.
It are the Mentats, right? Raised from birth, sort of like Vulcans almost.
Yeah. The Mentats are awesome. You got Bradley Dourif with big bushy eyebrows and gross red lips because they're drinking some kind of they're sipping on gin and juice. They're doing something. I don't know what it is exactly.
That was a David Lynch
creation
flourish
to make them look cool.
Well, hold on one sec. It was
because the Fremen have the blue eyes.
He says a prayer, doesn't he? And it's like,
yes,
it is by will alone. I set my mind in motion. It was by, I'm trying to look for it.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things. Number one,
but Lynch made that up. So that's the story in Dune. Humanity rebels against artificial intelligence. And you're right. You know, one reason, one of many reasons, Jordan, that I love Dune is, you know, the movie's strongest when Lynch doesn't explain shit to you. And so he never explains, you know, what's his name?
Thufir.
Yeah, Thufir. Thank you. Too much saliva in my mouth.
Yeah.
That never explains, you know, there's a scene where he's sitting down and performing calculations and lights are flashing in his eyes. Like, they never explain who these people are. And yeah, that's okay. Because as a little kid, I was like, oh, they're brains.
Yeah, you get it when you're not thinking. This goes back to something we said in a different recording. It's like you get this movie when you're not thinking about it. You know, if you analyze it too much, it starts to fall apart. But when you're a kid, you're able to get it more because it just kind of flows.
Yeah, here is the prayer, the Mentat mantra that David Lynch wrote
for Brad Dourif.
Right, and remember, Brad Dourif is drinking there's some kind of berry juice.
Yeah.
It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. It is by the juice of Sappho that thoughts acquire speed. The lips acquire stains. The stains become a warning. It is by will alone I set my mind in motion. That's what human computers say. That's how they pray.
I mean, it is by will alone. And it's not that dissimilar from the mantra about fear. You will yourself not to have fear. Fear is the mind killer. You will the fear away, or you will yourself not to care about the fear. You know, and the Fremen are the most human of all, right? Because they, you know, they're fighting for justice. They're fighting for their people. And yet their mantra is not that dissimilar from the human computers. It's heavy shit, man.
So it is heavy shit. So Star Trek embraces technology.
Yes.
And so technology is bound to fail the Federation.
I mean, there's a whole world of literature.
Isn't that the flaw in Star Trek, ultimately, is that for all of its humanist sort of core, that it is a series that tells us to have faith in technology above all other things?
That's a good question. And I don't think so, because all of the most highly advanced technology in Star Trek, which would be Data, and then the Doctor on Voyager, Seven of Nine, all of those characters have deeply embedded in them Pinocchio syndrome. All they want in life is to be more human. It's sort of a baked in, you know, they'll never rebel. There'll never be the singularity where the machines rise. And in fact, in the great fifth season episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, Unification 2, in which Spock and Data finally sit side by side to hack through a Romulan computer server, they realize that they are sort of flip sides of one another. Spock is a half human, half Vulcan, who more so than every other Vulcan has been striving to tamp down his emotions and achieve a more cold, calculating lifestyle, whereas Data is artificial and can never truly have a humanity. And there's a moment of sadness between the two of them. You know, Data expresses it blankly. Spock at least just says fascinating in his way. You know, cause neither of them can actually, you know, cause they got all kinds of problems, man. They can't really speak their emotions. So I agree with what you're saying that, you know, Star Trek really does elevate these sort of, you know, robo characters for a very simple reason, is because, and I'll just say it as a huge Trekkie, the fans really like it because there is, I don't want to say a streak, I want to say a wide swath of neurodivergent Star Trek fans who glom on to, in each iteration of Star Trek, this character that has, you know, quasi autistic qualities, be it Spock, Data, Odo, Seven of Nine, T'Pol, if you want to go to Enterprise. Every series has that character, and it's always the favorite character from a wide group of
right, because of in that character you can have the conversation about what it means to be human from different You know, because it's like, that's one reason I loved Odo, right? For one, for many reasons. One of which is that he's one of the few Star Trek characters who could be a member of the X-Men. Is that he never seemed to really want to be human.
Yeah, that's a good point about Odo. He is a little different.
He longed for other things, because he was, you know, he longed to know of his origins. Eventually he learns of his origins and he rejects them. And he learns to love a human, but it was interspecies love.
Right. Yeah, it's true. And I think the audience really likes it because these characters are so out in the open. There's no fear. There's no embarrassment. They're just going to talk about, Seven of Nine. And you look at the actress, Jeri Ryan, all sexed out to the nines. She's like, let us commence with fornication. He says it to Harry Kim, or I forget the exact line. But it's just like so on the nose that it's very freeing, you know? And to get it back to Dune, Lynch keeps us at such a reserve that we have to assume, and I'm agreeing with you here a little bit, with the sort of formal conversation that House Atreides has and everybody from Caladan and the way they are so like, Duncan Idaho, so good to see you, that I feel like those sort of like very honest and open conversations might have happened. You compare that to the gross, repulsive Harkonnens who talk like regular movie villains, right? The Harkonnens are more human than the Atreides are, you know?
Right.
I think that that element of what you're responding
that's
to.
That's an interesting point because, you know, I want to get back to, because I want to talk about in some ways, you know, if Star Trek doesn't fit within Dune, I do think Star Trek fits within Dune because in some ways I think Dune is a more mature track, but let me get to that in a second.
Whoa.
Atreides. That's a very interesting point. And I'm going to think about it. We're going to talk about it again. I promise not to call you at 3 a.m. like I did a few weeks ago. But like, you know, the Harkonnens, there's no obvious religious corruption. House Atreides has a direct connection to the Bene Gesserit. And again, there are all of these religious and quasi-religious factions that are either good, that, you know, I'm not going to say they're good or bad, but they have their self-interest. The Harkonnens, at least in Lynch's Dune, don't seem to have any connection to the religions of Dune, which I find interesting because in Dune, religion wins and technology fails.
In Dune, religion wins and technology fails. That is correct. Yeah.
Yeah, in Herbert's future, belief structures are what organizes humanity, but they have killed the Datas. They have killed the intelligent machines. Yeah. And you're right, that Star Trek, the tentpole character, for lack of a better term, is always going to be a character that wrestles in some way with what it is to be human or not human. I still contend that the special sauce of Star Trek is the technology and that there are some people, you know, it's the technology and it's and you know, it's the weaponry.
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah.
The only reason I call Dune more mature is that it is not, the point isn't toys. The point is, I would even go so far as to say that Paul's transformation is a rejection of humanity. Like Roddenberry obviously held humanity in high regard, but maybe we're awful.
I mean, you're absolutely right that the tech element is something that is the most important thing to many Trek fans. And is certainly, if you look at the amount of books that have been published about, the blueprints of the Enterprise, it's out of control. I think what you say about Dune as, the rejection of all technology, at least Lynch's Dune, I have to disagree a little bit because so much of what makes it so visually appealing are the ships and the weirding modules and, just the dials and doodads.
But that's yet another conversation. You know, there was something proto steampunk.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
About Dune's design, about Lynch's design. And, I want to talk about the design, because I'm a huge fan of Bob Ringwood, who was the costume designer, who's very influential, designed Burton's Batman suit. But there was something industrial, almost Eraserhead-like. There was something industrial age about the Dune technology that was also anti-technology.
I feel like, yeah, you're right. The visual thing is a whole other conversation. But you mentioned also the toys. I'm just curious. Did you ever have, as a kid, did you ever have any Dune toys?
I had the,
like, maybe one of the worms. Yeah.
I will talk to you about worms, about the worms when you properly respect.
All right.
Those magnificent creatures. I had all the toys, I had all the toys, and literally no one wanted to play with me because they're not compatible, right? Because if one of your friend has Cobra Commander and someone else has Darth Vader, and then a fat little Baron Harkonnen floats over with black toe polish. Like, no one, who wants to play with that? You know, like the Sardaukar warrior is like, oh, look, here's a trash bag man. Like, no one wants to play with.
No.
Anyway,
John, they might have. It might have. I mean, yeah, it could have been they didn't want to play with you because of your toys.
They didn't want to play with you for other reasons. You know why? Because they didn't want to talk about Dune. And I wish that you had been in my life when I was a 9, 10, 11, 23, 24, 35. Actually, we've known each other longer than that. I just wanted to. That's my theory. It's not well thought out at all. It just occurred to me that it's possible that there's 800 years between Dune and where we last have seen the Federation. So any number of fucked up things can happen.
Well, you know, it's funny you should say it, because season 3 of Discovery, which is happening right now, takes a fast forward 900 years and the Federation is dead.
What?
Oh, I mean, this is not a spoiler. This is on right now. So this corroborates a lot of what you're thinking to a degree.
Have they bumped into any gigantic naked space baby spice creatures?
It just started. And I know you're in the middle of season 2 of Discovery.
So yeah, I literally had no interest in these new Star Trek shows. And then when I was talking to you last, I tentatively dipped a toe back in, and they're doing, it's fine.
Yeah, it's better.
It's fine.
Well, so just without giving you the reasons why, season 3, episode 1, they fast forward 900 years to a side of Star Trek we've never seen, not even in that weird episode of Enterprise where they have the Enterprise J. It's ahead of that. Not as far ahead as Dune in the year 10,191 or whatever it is, but in this time period, the Federation has fallen and our heroes are trying to put it back together again.
I don't know if I like that.
What do you mean? This is what you were just saying. This corroborates your whole story.
It corroborates it if in 900 years there is this powerful coven of space witches that are still trying to destroy the patriarchy, and they've got special powers.
The Kwisatz Haderach.
Don't disrespect.
I'm sorry, but I think I don't know. We might see it in the new Discovery. I don't know.
Jordan, I got to make chicken paprikash.
Oof, I love that.
Thank you. I brought my Instant Pot from New York City to where I'm spending the pandemic in White Plains, and I'm going to make chicken paprikash
with rice.
Extra wide egg noodles.
Oh, not a bad idea. Spätzle would work too. A little spätzle.
Spätzle would work, but I don't want to make spätzle. I'm going to make chicken paprikash.
Yeah, I like it with rice, but you do you.
Do you? All right, let's do the thing that I like to do, and you're the only person that does it with me.
Yeah, I'll do it.
Sounds wrong. Thank you. We're going to read the Litany of Fear.
Yeah. Next time we have a Dune conversation, I'd like to talk a little bit about this litany, because I don't know if I agree with it 100%, but I'll read it with you. Don't worry.
Well, you got to think of it, as partly kind of mid-century psychedelic self-help, Aleister Crowley sort of like bullshit, But also, fear is the fucking mind killer, Jordan. Let me tell you something, okay? David Lynch did not let the fear of the failure of Dune kill his ambitions. Boom.
True. True. You know that Frank Herbert got laid so much by telling women that fear is the mind killer. Like, he used that line to get him in the bed.
The 60s were not a great time. We are going to do the Litany of Fear. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
Okay.
I'm ready. I must not fear.
Must not fear. Fear.
Fear is the mind killer.
Fear is
the fear is death the little death
that brings, total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it
to pass over me
and through me.
And when it has gone past,
I will turn
the inner eye to see its path. Where the fear has gone,
there will be nothing.
There will be nothing.
Only I
will remain.
Goodbye, Jordan.
See ya.
Hey, Jordan.
Yeah.
Look, I know that I am calling you late at night to talk to you about Dune, but let's break the conceit for a moment. We're taking a couple weeks off to celebrate. What do they call
it? The end of the year.
Yeah, Christmas.
Christmas, Boxing Day, Kwanzaa, New Year's, that little perineum between Christmas and New Year's Eve, you know, that weird interzone.
That word was at your fingertips too easily. I don't even want to go back there. Anyway.
No. So we're taking a little time off, and we'll be back in early January.
Right. To talk about Dune.
I'm hoping that one day we'll talk about something else, but for now we'll talk about Dune.
There is nothing. There is no other movie. There is only Dune. Maybe Yentl.
Yeah, Dune and Yentl. Those are the two.
You do love Yentl.
The Dune Conversations is a Pink Jeans production. It's hosted by John DeVore and Jordan Hoffman and produced by Rob Schulte and Brittany High. This episode was edited by Jeremy Siegel, who also composed all of the music. To support this podcast and all Pink Jeans productions, please go to patreon.com/pinkjeans. Thanks. We'll see you on the next episode of The Dune Conversations.